Welcome back to this third and final portion of today's 6CEU seminar regarding de-stressing the therapist and preventing burnout. In this last section, we're really going to talk about what constitutes burnout and some things to be aware of. Again, as I stressed in our last section, a lot of times the tools that we use in terms of cognitive behavioral work with our clients are also things we can even use with ourselves in terms of recognizing irrational, absolute expectations that we have that might be rather unrealistic for ourselves or for the work we do, and then changing them to healthier, realistic ways of looking at things. So let's look at some of the categories of symptoms of burnout. The first category, which tends to be what most clinicians are often aware of, is that of emotional exhaustion. This can be summarized by statements like, I just feel drained. The person going into work just feels like they're tired even before they get started. And then when they start hearing the client's narrative and dealing with the empathy and the compassion of that, they just feel all the more drained. By the end of the workday, they may feel used up. They feel fatigued when they get up in the morning. The idea of thinking about another day, hearing client stories, presenting problems, and doing the type of work we do just creates stress in and of itself. They have this sense that working all day with people is draining to them. They feel like they're at the end of their rope, and they feel like they have no energy left when they counsel people. Another symptom of burnout that you want to look out for is a sense that you can no longer give as much of yourself to clients professionally as you used to in the past. You might feel like the job takes much out of you, and you feel less pleasure in it than you used to. Remember when we started today's seminar, we talked about the various reasons that people choose to be mental health therapists. And oftentimes, there's an array of rewards that we go into it assuming. Things about helping people, making a difference in their life, being able to teach pro-social skills, give a different sense of perspective, and on and on. But when we're in the middle of burnout, oftentimes, that joy seems to be lacking. Remember, as I said in the past, burnout only occurs when you go into something with a passion and a fire and a sense of enthusiasm. You can't burn out unless at one point that fire, that intensity was there. Another symptom of burnout is increasingly cynical attitudes about the counseling field. You might start to feel like you understand why your clients are fed up with the system. You might see some sense of injustice, may feel like the social systems are not providing equal opportunities to clients. You may hear their frustrations, and when they feel trapped and like they can't get the safety, the housing, the food, the basic needs that they have, or they just don't know how to use certain skills and relationships to have healthy interpersonal relationships, mood stability, freedom from addiction, or a host of different types of mental health concerns that our clients might present with. Over time, you may even start to feel like you're having negative or critical self-evaluations. You might feel like hard on yourself about the areas that you're not making as much of a difference as you think you used to. So as we spoke about earlier, in terms of the factors that contribute to burnout, initially we go in with certain cognitive expectations of ourself, of the setting we're in, of our clients. That can weigh into burnout when there's that discrepancy between the expectations and what actually happens. Now, time spent in the field doesn't necessarily mean we're more burnout prone. This is where the literature is really tricky and how we have to interpret it. On the one sense, over time, if you spent more time in the field, you have more potential exposure to different types of presenting problems. You've probably seen more cases, maybe been exposed to a higher degree of trauma. But it's not necessarily because you've worked longer, but it may be not just the time spent in the field that makes a difference with the burnout. It can instead be the type of cases you see and how well they're balanced with your personality, with your scope of practice, and your competency areas. And it also can be a matter of looking at how much or how little of life is balanced between your work and your leisure time. So I've cited here in the literature some of the actual irrational beliefs of burnout-prone therapists. And as I read these, again, if you notice yourself in these, don't assume that it means that you should never have been in the mental health field. But just use it as a tool to realize that there are some irrational beliefs that we have, that over time, the enthusiasm that we went in with causes us to think that, oh boy, you know, if I'm having any challenges or if there's things I need to brush up on or have supervision on or difficult clients, you know, we start having our doubts about if we should be in the field. So this doesn't mean you should necessarily not be in the mental health field, but maybe that we need to apply some of the same cognitive behavioral type of cognitive debating skills that we teach our clients. So the first belief, the irrational belief, is I should always work at my peak level of enthusiasm and competence. I should be able to cope with any client emergency. I should be able to help every client. Client lack of progress is my fault. You see how, with those, why they're irrational? You hear that absolute type of belief. All or nothing. So it's just as simple as if only I was able to be accessible all the time, handle everything, fix it, it would be better. But the fact is that there are some things our clients bring in. There's various levels of how invested they are and how ready for treatment or ready for change when we talk about stages of change. That's why I think highlighting that therapy is a cooperative venture and therapeutic partnership is really important early on. It also gives an expectation that there will be, quote, homework and exercises and applications expected of the client outside of sessions. I'll even say stuff to clients about how I believe that in many ways they're a better reporter of what's going on with them because they spend more time within their life. And there's a lot of hours that they spend beyond the counseling session. So we can't be too hard on ourselves about being able to meet every possible need and every answer. And that total responsibility is ours. Let's look at some other irrational beliefs that burnout-prone therapists might have. Things like client lack of progress is my fault. I should always be available when clients need me. I should be able to work with all types of clients. I should be on call always. How about this next one? Client needs come before my own needs. I'm responsible for my clients' behaviors. I have the power to help, control, or fix a client. It's selfish to put myself first. And can you hear a lot of these mimic the things that our clients come to us about? It's selfish to put myself first. How many times have you or I said to a client, that self-care is not selfish. That setting boundaries can be one of the most kind, loving things that we do. But yet, do we really apply that in our own clinical professional life? What about there's no time for self-care? This idea of, well, maybe someday I'll have a chance. So the cognitive behavioral cycle is something you might want to just remind yourself of as you reevaluate some of these irrational beliefs. We know that we might not be able to change some of our own feelings of frustrations if you're in a setting that might not be the best match for you, if your client load or caseload is rather demanding, if the agency standards seem to be excessive, if there's ambiguity about what's expected of you. So we might not be able to directly change the feelings, but we can look at what pressure we're putting on ourselves. If it's realistic, if the things that we're focusing on are truly our clinical responsibilities, or are we balancing them out with what the client expectations should be? We can also look at what are realistic goals. Are the goals, is the treatment plan actually concrete, behavioral and measurable? Looking at the behaviors and the actions. So things that I would teach a client in terms of red flags that contribute to irrational thoughts are some of the same stuff that could be red flags for us that contribute to burnout. Things like shoulds and ought tos. Belief patterns of if only then statements. Things like if only I do A, B, and C. If only I help and fix enough. If only I'm accessible enough. If only I do a little more and put in a little more hours, more time, more availability, then my clients will blah, blah, blah. Absolute beliefs about, I guess I'm a good therapist, I'm successful, I'm a role model in the field, I'm doing well with my clients if ABC happens, or maybe I'm a failure, maybe I ought not to be in the field. But we need to test those out because, again, those are really absolute thoughts and adjectives. We want to look at the actual behaviors in terms of, okay, what evidence and what facts do I have that I'm not keeping up, I'm not doing what is ethically and professionally required of me as a therapist. Another thing that we have to look at is, do we have thoughts in terms of have-tos? I have to do this. If I don't do this, my client's going to have A, B, and C struggle, as if it would be awful for clients to have any struggle. Or this idea, this arbitrary and ambiguous idea of doing enough. So what happens when we're struggling with something like potential burnout is we tend to do toxic behaviors, and those can either come out in perfectionism, workaholism, and trying to do more and work harder, or they can come out in a way of checking the time, trying to avoid, can't wait to get to the end of your day, talking constantly about how you can't wait to get to the end of your career to where you can retire. So how do we deal with these irrational beliefs? We can use some of the similar types of cognitive debating strategies we might use with a client. So what about, is this a fact or is it just an opinion? Is it a fact if I do all the good, right, strong, and perfect things as a therapist, I'm a success? I really, really have shown and demonstrated well my licensure. I am a model therapist. And if my client's frustrated at all, then I must be horrible. If I have any rough spots with a client or feel like I'm ever at an impasse, then it means I'm an awful therapist. No, that's not necessarily a fact. It may be a strong opinion. It may be a very strong feeling. Is there any other way of looking at this? According to whom? So who says that? What evidence do I have? Is this belief life-giving or death-producing? Now, that could be on several levels. Is it eating away at my health? Am I just trying to jump through every hoop to meet productivity and not having work-life balance? Am I drained? Am I tired? Am I emotionally just spent? Or is this something that, even while it can be tiring and taxing, that if I do consult with other colleagues, get supervision, and have appropriate balance in my life, that I can do pretty well in the field? Then finally, we really need to come to the fact of saying, if this belief, the irrational, burnout-prone, stressful belief, is not helpful to me, how can I continue telling myself this? So let's look at some healthier self-messages that might be better alternatives. Things like, I would like to do my best with this effort, but I don't have to be perfect. I'm still a good person, even when I make a mistake. I can do something well and appreciate it without it being perfect. I'll be happier and perform better if I try to work at a realistic level rather than demanding perfection of myself. It's impossible for anyone to function perfectly all the time, and signs of burnout don't mean I'm a weak person. One of the things you may actually need to do, and one of the reasons why having colleagues for scope of practice, ethics, and for supervision is important, is because then you can check what your roles and responsibilities are and how you're spending your time. We do have so many responsibilities and things that we may have to juggle, but we want to be realistic about this. Things like assessing a client, doing diagnosis of a client, providing relevant treatment for DSM disorders, doing sometimes insurance paperwork, billing, case notes, up-to-date education or CEUs, consultation with colleagues, awareness of and adherence to agency standards. So you see, there's a lot of different areas we may be juggling. And again, to say that I have to do all of these perfectly without ever feeling tired or upset or having anything to, complain about is sometimes unrealistic. Now, let's look at the literature in terms of what the literature says about how we do with reaching out for help. Honestly, the literature would suggest that we don't do so well. We really struggle in admitting that we even have problems. Because again, we're supposed to be the therapist, the counselor, the so-called expert. It's hard for us to admit we have problems. And as much as we advocate for the services that we offer, that they're beneficial and useful for our clients, the literature out there in terms of the research would show that most of us, when we even come to a point where we think we need outside help, do not seek out therapy for ourselves. We think, well, maybe if I just think a little differently, maybe if I talk to myself enough this way, there's a sense of, oh, I'm weak if I go to a therapist. Many of us struggle with setting boundaries regarding sticking to the time in session or regarding the idea that counseling is a profession, is a business, and there are fees and requirements. There are things that we hope a client will do outside of session in terms of following up on homework and applying skills. Things that we also struggle with are things like advertising or marketing. A lot of times, we might not be the best business people, but that's an aspect that we do need to consider. And sometimes we struggle with even negotiating for clients, for access to services, for talking to insurance companies, for getting them linked to other things beyond our office that they might need access to. I want to help you with the distinction that the literature makes between caseload versus workload. So it's not necessarily the amount of time with direct client contact and work functions that contributes to burnout. But the caseload, so who is included in that workload? Are you talking about highly intense clients? Clients that can be emotionally draining? More mandatory referred clients? Are we talking about clients that push your buttons or really are the types of clients that for you are personally draining? Are there certain type of diagnoses that are more challenging for you to work with? I think it's really important that we all know what our strengths are and what our weak areas are, and that we have an array of different colleagues that we can make good referrals to who might actually enjoy some of the types of clients that might not be our cup of tea. I remember in the past of my practice having one lady who really did well with mandated court clients, addicts, and loved working with personality disorders. She was able to set boundaries, was matter of fact, but still friendly and compassionate. Whereas some of the type of clients that may have been more easy for her, or she developed a system that worked with them, might have been harder for me in some respects. So we're looking at support systems. We're looking at making sure we have supervision and consultation for ourselves. Remember, when we're talking about counselor wellness, we're talking about both outcome and process. So what does wellness include? Now, some of this stuff that I'm going to share with you that I've listed may totally sound like common sense. But the reason I share it, as common sense as it may sound, is that these are the things that I still see, whether within myself at times or whether within colleagues in the mental health field, that we struggle with. Again, we're so good at suggesting them to clients. We're so good at doing behavioral plans with our clients. But then when it comes to ourselves, we struggle. First area, the physical. Do we get enough sleep and quality sleep? What about healthy eating? Like I say many times when I do these self-care seminars for professionals, I talk about how a lot of times part of the problem is, you know, we end up eating a quick candy bar, a pop, a sugary thing, or if there's a quick energy type of thing, that's all we do. Instead of take a piece of fruit, a bottle of water, or something that is healthy. One of the other aspects of physical that we need to look at is making sure we're alert and aware and we're able to be maximally present with our clients. This may sound again like common sense, but I have had clients that when I've asked them in the first diagnostic assessment about what they liked or didn't like, if they had any opinion about any past counseling that they had been to in terms of what worked or what didn't work, you'd be surprised how many of them told me that past therapist fell asleep on them, past therapist ate during their session, past therapist were on the phone and picked up the phone all the time while they were supposed to be giving them time for their session. So being attentive to them really makes a difference to our clients. Another one is, and this becomes an ethical issue, are we able to physically accomplish the tasks of counseling? Is our health enough where it needs to be to where we're able to be there for clients? Do we have a somewhat regular schedule of meals? Are we having sufficient liquid intake? Are we aware of hunger and thirst? Do we limit our sugar intake so we don't have those peaks and valleys? Do we have a routine physical exam? You know, it's interesting because even in the last year, and this was in more than one setting that I worked at, I was surprised that it wasn't necessarily, you know, older people, but even younger people who were working in the mental health field who really, really struggle with all kinds of body aches, pains, difficulties with self-care. So we have difficulty monitoring our personal needs. Another thing in terms of the physical we need to watch out for is, are we creating in our personal life and professional life what I consider a warm environment? Whether it's soft music, flowers, pictures, are we allowing for breaks in a non-counseling way? I know sometimes people spend their free time even about really intense stuff, and that doesn't help us rejuvenate. What about the emotional area of wellness? Do we have the skills that we need to in terms of helping clients process their feelings and issues? Are we balancing insight, awareness, and action? Do we allow for insight and awareness in our own lives? A lot of times, this can be limited if we don't have regular supervision or regular colleagues that we talk to about things. Again, we can't highlight enough the balance between social time, time alone, work and leisure time, having adequate professional training and competency, evaluating caseload, evaluating how much time you're putting or not putting in terms of vacation or breaks, recognition of small victories in spite of challenges. I think this one gets overlooked a lot of times. I would encourage you, when you have a chance, almost like to keep a little notebook without any identifying information and names or anything where people can go back or any breaches of confidentiality, but just a general thing. Maybe I remember when I first started out, so-and-so situation with this person who was so resistant, who just ranted and raved about how they did not like counseling, didn't want to be in counseling, it couldn't do anything for them, they were resistant, they just spent all their time trying to convince me how awful counseling was going to be. But then after 3 months, ABC happened, and they were actually doing some of the techniques. They were actually advocating for counseling. What they thought was going to turn out like a nightmare actually became a tool that they used. So you may want to have little reminders. Maybe you have a little index card somewhere. Maybe you have a little notebook. That might be a neat thing to share, even in terms of a staff meeting at the agency or company you work at, in terms of just the victories. Because it's so easy for us, especially with stress and burnout, to focus on the challenges. Another thing that can help us emotionally is to have flexible thinking, to revisit our successful, quote-unquote, client files and look at what was different. Were we more balanced in how we approached things? Did we highlight the policies and procedures more clearly? Were we both personal and empathic, but also better at the business end of things? Did we highlight the cooperative venture of the therapeutic relationship? Some other areas we can look at are our personal growth throughout time and practice. What we've discovered about who we are, what we've reevaluated. And then the types of interests that we have outside of counseling. So let's look at more healthy beliefs we can come up with in this emotional area. Things like, I'm not weak if I rely on my colleagues and support systems. I don't have to answer every problem. I'm not on call. I'm not a counselor 24 hours a day, every day. It's not my responsibility to be everything to everybody. Some general things for wellness we can look at are really evaluating if there are any unresolved issues, whether with our clients that we might need to revisit, something we might need to reevaluate in terms of a treatment plan, or something in our own life so that we don't end up with what's called vicarious traumatization. We need to make sure we have that network professionally We need to look at a development of a healthy lifestyle. We also need to make a distinction between caring for others and caring about them. I frequently talk to people with codependent qualities about this, but I think the concept can apply to any of us. When you're in a caring, giving profession, a lot of times setting boundaries is something that we need to learn. We also need to reconceptualize this whole idea of being an expert. Whether you're a supervising counselor, whether you're someone who owns a company or is a director of a department somewhere, we need to get away from this, I'm someone with all the answers. But maybe, yeah, I might have more experience, but we're all learning. One of the best things we can do in terms of healthy self-care is making sure the agency that you work for has a clear contract about what the job roles and tasks are, that we charge an appropriate fee, that we keep our own professional development up to date, that we keep an idea about expectations ahead of time so there's some structure for supervision sessions, that we have an idea ahead of time about how someone will let go of stress at the end of the workday. So what are some of the tasks of wellness? Spirituality, having a sense of meaning and purpose, where I fit in the world, self-direction, an idea that I do have some self-control over things, an acceptance of I, like everyone else, am someone with shortcomings and strengths, development of realistic belief systems, learning techniques for self-soothing, developing creative problem solving, having goals, whether it's personal or professional goals, and learning to balance work and leisure. Not just developing competencies, as we talk about in terms of ethics with our profession, but a sense of reward and competency even in our personal life. Balancing being and doing. Friendship. Having relational connection with others. Asking for help when needed. Extending outreach to others. Another aspect the literature talks about in terms of wellness is what they call love. Building trust in your ability to give and receive love from others. Having stability in your close relationships, and knowing that someone really cares for you. Another phrase that the literature talks about is temporal selectivity. We can be time conscious about how we plan our days and how we juggle our tasks. Like I said, we can rearrange our schedule. These can contribute to what I talk about in the literature calls counselor stamina, our ability to withstand and hold up under pressure. There's 7 principles of counselor stamina. So first of all, selectivity. We can choose what we're going to focus on. This could be from the tasks we do, what populations of clients we serve, how many cases we see, and what constitutes those cases, limiting how many areas we say are in our scope of practice so we're not overloaded, and having reasonable goals and objectives. We can also look at the idea of being conscious of our time and how we divide that up. Accountability, which involves relationship partnering with credible colleagues. Keep in mind, there's several reasons for this. One is to develop a standard of care. What would other people in a similar situation with similar types of clients do? This also helps us in terms of ethics and practice. A fourth area we can look at is measurement and management of resources. We can look at what's called agency. When I talk about seminars of instilling hope, I talk about making sure that we have personally meaningful goals. And then the concept of resiliency. Because even when we do, notice I said when, not if, when we do have difficult clients, the resiliency will mediate the effects of stress. So there will be stress, but realizing that it's an opportunity to grow, that a lot of times the things in life that we grow through are not necessarily the easy things that work out well off the bat, but things over time where we have to actually employ some of our resources or learn a new skill or consult with someone, and we realize we have more strength than we realize. That's why I love the solution focus and strengths-based kinds of stuff, because they look at the idea of how we manage, even when we don't feel like we're managing. That might be a question you want to consider even in your own life right now. There's probably a reason you're looking at the issue of stress and burnout and looking at how have I managed? Because you might not feel like you're managing well and juggling well, but how are you managing and what would it take to manage from this point? Now, Cashwell, Bentley, and Bigley talk about a concept called spirituality. And this closely ties to what in the recent literature they talk about in terms of mindfulness. Being in the here and now, being aware of the present. They also talk about combining mindfulness with what they say heartfulness, compassion, and love. And then soulfulness, having connections beyond yourself. They do mention that this is meant to be developmental. These are not things that everybody just has off the bat. Again, we're talking about not just an outcome, but a process. This might involve sense of humor. It might involve being altruistic with others and learning to accept, again, both the good and the bad. Being spontaneous, but also focusing on just simplicity, creativity. There's a model out there called the Wellness Wheel Model. There's a lot of aspects that they talk about that all are kind of like pieces to a pie that all weigh into the concept of wellness. So the people who have discussed this wellness model talk about having a good sense of your worth just as a person, who I am, not just a counselor, but a person. All the aspects of who you are, your sense of control, that it's not just things in life are just being imposed upon you from difficult clients or life's throwing too much at you, or that it's all inside of you, but that there's a balance. Realistic belief systems, that there's intellectual stimulation, problem solving, creativity, a sense of humor, and then physical and emotional wellness. Another person reconceptualizes wellness in terms of what they call the tree of counselor well-being. They talk about the branches being our professional activity that help support the things that we're doing. Things like our clinical relationships with colleagues and supervisees, or the theoretical schemas we might work under, the professional roots that we have, and then the branches of personal activity. So we have personal and professional that are both branches. They're building us up in a different way. Personal time, community life, family time, vacation, personal relationships with family and friends, spirituality. Now what's interesting, and you'll probably get a kick out of, and I'm reading these literal phrases from this article, are things they call leaf mites, the managed care companies, the lightning bolt, might be a malpractice suit, attacks of parasites and insects, vicarious traumatization. So we have these things that we hyper-focus on that we think eat away at who we are and what we're doing. But if we build up the branches, if we build up those support systems, they help us not just hyper-focus on those. So things that we want to avoid are getting stuck on our own personal history of trauma, That way, vicarious traumatization, when we have a client with difficult issues that could be very traumatic, might not be an issue for us. Or if you realize something's an issue for you, getting the counseling and help you need to resolve any unresolved issues. Some of the things that also you want to be aware of is if in your own life there's any history of psychiatric issues, any current life stresses that really take you away from being present as you need to be. Also, your own developmental level, professionally and in the field. There may be a sense of inadequacy. There may be some parts that you feel like you could learn. One of the things that also can eat away at the foundation is when you have high levels of empathy, particularly with traumatized clients and you over-identify with them, or that you play over and over in your mind a lot of graphic details about trauma. So some of the things that can balance that out, again, are self-care, support from colleagues, sense of humor, and also having balance with what types of clients you take. Making sure your foundation is in the soil of relationship connection with colleagues, with work-life balance. Have deep roots in terms of a sense of meaning, a sense of spirituality of who you are in your existence and what that means. The key is having empathy without loss of yourself. It's important when a client's sharing with you his or her story to hear the client's account without putting ourselves into it. So you can share with your client about how you're experiencing the story and check in with them, but you need to have a balance to where their story doesn't become your own story. The number one factor in the literature in terms of wellness and protecting against stress and burnout is social support systems. Social supports help facilitate compassion. They normalize our feelings, reduce self-blame, and again, help us see that realistic self-acceptance. Some things that may be important that you may want to look at is developing reinforcements. Initially, when we go into the field, we assume that helping others, being there for them, teaching them counseling skills in and of itself is going to be reinforcing. But as we talked about earlier, sometimes certain agencies and settings we work in aren't particularly reinforcing. Sometimes we have rather difficult clients to deal with, and that may not feel particularly reinforcing. But I'd encourage you to actually spend maybe 5 or 10 minutes and again, take out that sheet of paper and that pen or pencil I spoke about earlier and look at developing a sheet of what are reinforcements that are important to you. Think about who are the people that when you spend time with them, they really lift you up. Things that are life-giving, things that are positive, things that are a healthy distraction away from those irrational, burnout-prone types of beliefs we talked about. Things like hobbies. Just like we talk with our clients about assessing if they're still doing their hobbies, if they're still doing their leisure things, it's important to look at, have you spent less time doing the things that were enjoyable to you? Look at the TV shows you might like, your favorite foods, places to go, sports. Also, if you choose to do this activity and pause for a little while here and then come back, you may want to also look at what are things that are not reinforcing. Because the fact is, there needs to be enough balance to where even if you don't get the reinforcement you need at the setting that you're working at or from, you know, certain interactions with clients, there needs to be another way to fill that up. Otherwise, the burnout will settle in. So when we talk about wellness, we're talking about several things. Having reasonable therapeutic goals, hearing the client's narrative, looking at the timing of things, having realistic expectations, allowing their journey to be their journey. Leisure is directly related to the ability to cope. True leisure is related to that sense of spirituality that we talked about a little bit ago. It's related to connectedness and promotes balance. Some examples of comments that therapists made who had good work-life balance were things like, I can try to let things happen in the moment. I try to see the beauty in everything. Playfulness is not necessarily unproductive or wasteful. I can periodically revisit how I'm feeling and what I need. Meanings of my personal and career goals are allowed to change with age and life stage. So keep in mind, when you think of what's leisure for you, for someone else that might be work. I know some people that a good workout, a good, you know, at the gym, walking, lifting weights, running on a treadmill, that really can relieve stress. That can be a good leisure activity for some. For others are like, oh no, that just feels like another task. Some people, cooking, cleaning, meditation, physical labor, prayer, doing their hobbies. So I encourage you to take time and think about what really fills you up. Now the next part I wanted you to consider, and I want to highlight this, although I've highlighted it sort of in passing to this point, is looking at whether or not traumatic cases influence counselor burnout. So they can, but what's interesting, they actually can influence it in a positive direction in some cases. Just because we have traumatic or crisis-related cases doesn't mean that we're going to be worse off necessarily. It's not predictive. In fact, in many studies, about a third of people actually felt more positive when they were involved in helping in a disaster or a trauma. One, there was a sense of self-fulfillment, which tapped into one of the reasons that many of us become counselors to begin with, that we felt like we were altruistic, we were reaching out to others, we were able to see that, wow, there's a lot of post-traumatic growth. There's people that even in the midst of some horrible situations muster up the strength to do stuff. And it also reinforces to us that all humans go through some traumatic things to some degree. And when we witnessed others' resiliency, it can help us. Again, the key, as the literature would suggest, is the degree to which we've resolved our own issues, if there are any traumatic issues from our history. When we're talking about self-care, think of the idea as of a bank. What are some rewards that would act as deposits that you could put in your self-care bank? Then think of what are some things which drain you of healthy self-care. And like I said, as we go through today's seminar, this is a seminar with a lot of different ideas to think about, where you're going to want to pause in between And try these things out. Make a list of what are the deposits in your self-care account. What are the things that seem to fill you back up? Are they things that are possible at where you're working now? What are the things that drain you? One of the things you may also want to do, if you're someone who's big into like mindfulness, is maybe even look at developing a behavioral relaxation for yourself. If you do any relaxation work with your clients, you realize that for it to be most effective, it's important to involve all the senses. So I would suggest what I call a relaxation called your happy place. Think about what picture would you see when you think of your happy place, the place that fills you up, the place that is encouraging and life-giving to you. Picture it. Picture it with a lot of color and detail. See it. See the details in it. Feel it. Feel the touches, the sensations. Hear the calm around you. The key, again, is involving all your senses. So, for example, I've had a lot of people, in terms of clients, that have told me for them, something like a beach or walking along a shoreline, seeing a beautiful sunrise or sunset, seeing the calm, feeling the gentle breeze, just looking out in the distance and seeing this expansive water that is like, wow, and just hearing the quiet. For other people, it might be something else. But allowing yourself that time to really consider what that is for you. Now I'm going to jump down to when counseling becomes a crisis. Keep in mind that as counselors, part of what we do is empathy. But sometimes this can become an occupational hazard. So one of the things we need to do is if there is a genuine crisis, it's important to make sure that there are protocols in place, that there's policies and procedures, there's awareness of all staff about that, there's informed consent of clients, that there's ways of coping and dealing with counselor guilt or sadness, sense of inadequacy. Those are things we need to take a look at. I'm going to skip over a few of these that are repetitive to some of the stuff we already said here. Some of the things that you want to keep in check when we're talking about, do I have any unresolved issues? Are looking at things like side effects of exposure to trauma. As I mentioned before, about a third of the people surveyed said that they actually felt that they had some very positive post-traumatic growth or sense of resiliency from witnessing some crisis stuff with clients. But what happens and where the stress and burnout could take root is when it challenges what we call the assumptive world theory. The assumptive world theory is the idea that a lot of people come into the world and environment with this sense of that life is good, people are good, people basically have positive motives, that good things happen to good people. But the fact of the matter is, over time, when you see and hear some narratives, especially from our clients about different things that they're having to go to, it's easy to start to believe that maybe the world's not just a fun, happy, good place. There's some awful things that happen to very good, nice, kind, ethical, moral, nice-hearted people. That sometimes things don't make sense the way we expect that they would. And so that's one of the red flags that you really want to take a look at. If the cases that you're seeing are starting to get you to think about, I don't know if I believe anymore that the world's a good place. I don't know if I really feel like I can do strengths-based work with my client. I feel like inside I'm just as negative as my client, if not more. So those are things we want to look at. We want to look at, are you at a point where you're just feeling helpless? where it's very hard for you to even find the positive in the midst of what they're bringing to you. That's where you might want to talk with a colleague. Are you having any psychological symptoms on your own? So these are types of things you want to look at. Things that you want to look at are ideas about, did I do enough? Am I really cut out for this? What if my clients don't like me? What if this isn't what I expected? What about, is the money really worth it, even if I'm in crisis work? Or I want to be helpful, but I don't know that I'm allowed to be helpful in the way I can. Or the idea I should always be available. There needs to be a point at which we self-evaluate, or that we have other colleagues we trust who can do that. That they're able to look at, are we really attending as well as we think we are to our clients, but with boundaries and with balance? Is there direct eye contact and interest in their story, but seeing it as their story? Are we able to do perspective taking? Are we able to set boundaries about what we need and then have that balance? The key is having those 3 to 5 colleagues at least who can keep you in check. People who can normalize your stresses and develop you as a person. Burnout is a long-term consequence of the hazards of what we do. Stress is when we feel like we haven't done enough. But burnout is when we just keep doing more and more and more and more, and it's just too much. It's overload. Burnout happens when we have no more emotional reserve. Keep in mind, it's important to deal with counselor and therapist burnout, not just because it affects us professionally, but because it affects all aspects of your life as a person. And those in turn just cause a chain reaction and affect each other. And so even when you're trying to convey concern, it comes across as a detached concern, that it's not real genuine. Things you may want to think about is that those that tend to be most prone to burnout are those who desire excellence, those who pride themselves on really caring, those who were, quote, on fire before, like I said, who had that enthusiasm, those whose life meanings are intricately tied to others' reactions. So you might want to think, am I having lack of assertiveness? Am I having difficulty dealing with ambiguity at my job? Am I looking at the clock? Am I struggling with interpersonal dynamics? Am I having more debates and negative discussions with colleagues? There actually is a counselor burnout survey out there that I cited in the PowerPoint here. Some of the items that were strongly positively correlated with burnout that people tended to endorse were things like, I feel like I'm incompetent. I don't feel confident anymore. I feel ineffective. I have difficulties establishing rapport with clients. I'm not connected to my clients. Things that they felt also really contributed were not spending enough time with friends, having poor boundaries between work and professional life, not having enough time to engage in personal interest, the counseling job affecting personal life or home life, feeling tired and exhausted, having body aches, tightness in the back and shoulders, becoming physically ill, a sense of unfairness in the workplace, negative energy and perceptions from coworkers, struggling to be empathic. So we want to look at, even in our own life, how can we mitigate exposure to client suffering? How can we deal with the closer we feel like we're progressing to burnout? I like to use the Serenity Prayer. And this is something, again, where I'd encourage you to use that paper and pen or pencil and pause after I talk a little about this exercise and really try it for yourself. So the Serenity Prayer, which you probably heard, I'm not going to read the whole long version, but the idea is distinguishing between what I can control and what I can't control. If you think about some of the messages that I read earlier about the irrational beliefs of burnout-prone therapists, if you think about when you're tired, exhausted, and spent as a therapist yourself, oftentimes it's when we're focused on what I cannot control, what clients do outside of sessions, how much they apply or don't apply of what I've tried to teach them. I can't control certain factors, but I can control what I share in terms of policies and procedures, how we discuss informed consent, the boundaries in the office. I can control the supervision I receive. So, for example, let's take some of the goals that we might have for ourselves and look at the part of each goal we can control and we can't control. Like I said, oftentimes, the part we cannot control seems to be first and foremost in our mind. And that's the part we might need to release. So let's say you are someone who started being a therapist because you wanted to be helpful to people who have limited life skills or resources. Great goal. Nothing wrong with that goal. What can't I control? Sometimes it's hard to get access to those resources. Sometimes you're working in a setting, say you're working for a private business, where people with limited funds might not be able to access your services or might need to go to certain types of agencies versus others. So that can be very frustrating when you want to help people, that you can help them, but you may need to direct them and be aware of different services in the community. What I can control, I can listen to their narrative. I can link them to services that might complement what I'm able to offer. I can point them in the right direction. Let's look at another goal a counselor might have. I want to make a change in others' lives. How common is that when we think of going into that field? And yet over time, how much we realize what we can't control about others' lives. We might need to actually kind of surrender that over and look at, you know what, the fact is there's a lot of time that my clients are outside my office. There's plenty of other influences in their life, in their careers, in their day-to-day life. And I'm just one voice in the mix. What I can control is that 45 minutes a week that they're in a session with me. And control, I also use that somewhat, you know, loosely. Because again, control, not in a harsh way, but I can influence that. What about a counselor thinking a goal, I want to prevent people from going through suffering I did because of my own family background. So there's a lot of things you might not feel you can control about that. But what can you control? You want to be very careful, like I said earlier, about not making the client's narrative your narrative. It still needs to be their story. But there is a way to choose to focus on post-traumatic growth with clients. There is a way to do trauma-informed therapy that's both respectful of the things people have gone through and also developing in the long run skills to help them cope with that. What about this belief? I want to help others by seeing the good in themselves and life, even in spite of pain. Again, I might be able to teach some skills, some cognitive behavioral therapy. I might be able to offer some techniques. But ultimately, there's choices a client's going to have to make. So I would encourage you to actually pause this audio and take maybe about 10, 15 minutes and make three columns on your paper. What goals do you have for yourself? What you cannot control and how you'll end up releasing that, and what you can control. Another exercise that I use with clients that you might want to use with your clients, or you can use with yourself, I use the phrase, watch where you put your butts. So it's important to admit our feelings, concerns, questions, and stresses. But we want to make sure we tell ourselves the whole picture. So sometimes what we do is kind of bad. We'll say, well, yeah, I know that something good might happen today. I know that maybe I'll help one of my five clients of the day. But, man, that last one didn't seem to get anything out of my sessions. So that person, after the word but, is focusing on what they feel has not gone well. An alternative is to start with the concerns and feelings. Wow, that last client was really a challenge to me. And I think I'm going to need to get some extra supervision or kind of reevaluate some things to move on. But I know that I put in my best, and sometimes it is slow going with clients that they're at different places. Or man, that client was a challenge. But I'm reminded of the stages of change and that this client might actually not have come in really ready for change, but instead wanting to gripe about other people in their life. So what you can do with this technique I'm telling you of watch where you put your butts, and something you can even teach clients as well, but is to start with the part of the story that's frustrating you, the part that's making you feel more stressed and more prone to burnout, but end up with the total strengths-based statement, the affirmation, the behavior choice, the part you can control. So looking at that, now I'm going to jump down to here. Wait a minute here. How we describe our clients. One of the things that can cause us stress in life is the idea of how we describe our clients. When we describe them in critical, negative terms, they can make us feel more helpless. Things like the psychotic crazy man who talks to himself and is out of it. The borderline lady in room 103. The court referred sexual offender. Our most frequent flyer who just returned. Guess who's back? The aggressive wall puncher from last week. And you hear that tone when we're talking to other colleagues. How that just sets up negativity. So we're so hyper-focused on one aspect of a client that sets us up for stress and burnout. So let's look at how we might change our language when we're focusing on some of these difficult things with clients. This first example, someone says, "Can I have some help with that bizarre patient roaming the hall and staring into space? She's acting really crazy, and her eyes are just darting. She looks like she's ticked off and ready to kill someone. Don't think it's my day to die yet." And again, this would not be ethically and respectfully the way that someone should be talking about a client, even if it's not in front of a client. I know sometimes I've seen people with a dark sense of humor that work in the mental health field, but the fact of the matter is, when we're talking about respect for our clients and we're talking about our own wellness and having a tone that promotes wellness in whatever setting you're working in, part of that is looking at how we describe our clients and client situations. So how would we change that? How about talking to your colleague and say, excuse me, can I talk with you about the person that's in the hall? So-and-so in the hall really appears to be attending to stimuli right now and seems to be getting increasingly agitated. I'm thinking that we might need to decide on a plan to help her because I'm wondering if she's going to continue to escalate because she's looking pretty upset right now. You hear the difference? It's behavioral. It's looking at what can we do to help. What about this next one? Yes, I'm with that jailbird guy from the court with the piercings and tattoos. Only has a few felonies and a few misdemeanors. Just likes to assault people. Better be careful how we question him or we'll be next on his list. He looks awfully familiar. I'm sure he's been here several times before. Fact of the matter is, one, we don't want to stereotype our clients. No matter how they're looking, even if they have a court history, a jail or prison history, fact is, you know, if we're already painting this picture of, oh, this assault person, this person that I'm sure he's this, I'm sure he's that, that paints a picture that really doesn't help therapeutically. Instead of just relating to the person as a person, finding out what's going on, you know? So if there actually has been a behavioral history that says, oh, in his referral packet or in the information I got from the collateral sources, it says he's had a few assaults, I'm wondering what we can do to just be aware of that and look at some of the triggers. That's different than speaking the way this person's speaking. Let's look at the next example here. I don't know when in the heck I'll ever get out of here because that woman in room 200 is rattling off things a mile a minute. Can't get her to shut up. Seems like every night I really want to get off work on time, we get another storyteller who's loud and obnoxious. How many more times does she have to have relationships and end up getting people fed up with her before she realizes no one cares about her trivial garbage that she's calling a crisis? So honestly, there are times we're going to feel frustrated. We're going to feel like times where clients are taking things and calling it a crisis or making it a crisis. Remember, this is the way when we talked about defense mechanisms and things earlier, that it's not necessarily that they're manipulatively just trying to tick us off. But there's a reason that that has worked for them before. So, but it would be a red flag to me if I was starting to feel like, oh boy, here we go. Some trivial nonsense from this client. If we're to the point where we cannot empathize, I'm not saying you have to agree with your client's point of view. We cannot empathize and I say, oh boy, here we go with your trivial stuff. That would cause me to question, like, maybe do I need to take a vacation? Do I need to reevaluate the setting? Do I need to, you know, to where it's hard for me to have high levels of Rogers process variables? Or maybe do I need to talk with a supervisor about someone else working with this client because it's pushing my buttons and I'm really realizing I'm agitated inside because it sounds like while this clinician is describing the client as agitated and loud and she says she's, quote, loud, obnoxious, storytelling, I'm wondering if she's, quote, just manic. I think sometimes we personalize it. And one of the things we need to remind ourselves is it's not necessarily personal when someone's behaving a certain way. Look at this next one here. Someone saying, did you see that hoochie walk in? It's only 30 degrees out and she's in a tank top and shorts. Does she not realize everyone knows her for the histrionic borderline drama queen she is? She better not start with me. I know she plays her games with the other staff. I've heard horror stories about her. I've been lucky until now, but I don't want to deal with her nonsense. Again, we should not be talking to our colleagues like this. And all too often, when I worked in community mental health, I was absolutely shocked because I was trained in a background where, you know, professors were private practitioners. It was absolutely considered unethical to joke, belittle, or whatever about clients and to say these critical, I think personally demeaning types of things. But yet when I worked in community mental health, the majority of the staff would talk like that. When I worked in a hospital setting, many of the staff would talk like that. So except for the private practices I worked in and my own practice, that's when I didn't hear this type of stuff. But I think part of it is if you notice that negative tone because of the stress of the setting, it's important to be someone who starts a foundation of things don't need to be said this way. And the other thing I've read that was really heart-touching to me was the fact that instead of being angry and agitated about the stuff with clients, what would it be like to feel sad and grieve? The fact that someone is only in a tank top and shorts in 30 degrees, what more might there be to the narrative? To me, that's sad. It's not something I'd want to make light of. Maybe they don't have a big array of clothes. Maybe they're homeless. Maybe they, you know. And regardless if they did have a diagnosis of certain things, you know, we don't want to use all these labels. So what I want to do is I want to make sure that we have enough time to get to a few little exercises here before we wrap up. So again, I'd encourage you to get your paper and pen or pencil out. Let's look at this one. What do I want to be remembered for? If you're thinking about as time passes and when you're gone from this world, what is it you want people to remember? I'd like you to think about what are the most important 3 to 5 variables that you want memorialized about yourself. Are they that you're a helper, that you're a caring person, that you have a big heart, that you're altruistic? What are you doing to pursue these now as opposed to other things? Because, again, sometimes with stress and burnout, we tend to focus on the things that are our button pushers but are not really the things that are most important in our life. Things like, am I the most organized person? Did I follow the protocols perfectly? Those usually aren't the things that we want to be remembered for. While ethically, we do have to do our notes and things in a timely manner, while ethically, there are principles we have to follow. Usually there's reasons we got into the field to begin with, and it's important to look at those. Finally, I'd like you to also take some time to look at creating a self-pledge. Think about what your values and beliefs are. Think about using positive, affirming self-talk. What are the things you pledge to do? How do you plan to balance work and life? Do you maybe need to consider personal therapy to help you have increased empathy for your clients again, to catch triggers so your unresolved issues aren't spilling out into the sessions, to make sure that you're not at risk for ethical violations? I want to thank you for joining me for this seminar regarding stress and burnout. Make sure that you go to the home study test page on our website to do the mandatory home study test. And Please consider using us in the future for other continuing education projects. I wish you well in your endeavors in the field. Thank you. Bye.